Current State on WKAR. Nice to have you along today. Special millage elections are scattered around the Lansing area today. Among them, Waverly, Williamston, Bath, DeWitt, Fowler, Langsburg, and Pawama, Westphalia. If you live in one of those communities, get out and vote. According to a 2012 report by the Natural Resources Defense Council, as a region, bacterial levels of Great Lakes beaches exceeded public health standards more than beaches in any other region in the U.S. Contaminated water can cause illness and force beaches to close. Yesterday, I spoke with Dr. Joan Rose, the Nolan Endowed Chair of Water Research. Rose explained that Great Lakes beaches are sometimes more susceptible to pollution than coastal beaches.
We monitor water for a fecal bacterium called E. coli.
Yeah.
And that's what we use. And when we test the water, if the E. coli is too high, it means there's too much pollution and there's the potential for people getting sick. So each state has their own standard. And when that standard is exceeded, they put that advisory out or they close the beach. And that's how we get these numbers. And of course, what we're comparing in the Great Lakes, we're comparing the Great Lakes to the other coastal beaches. And so as you can imagine, this is a freshwater system in the Great Lakes. And sometimes it's just a bit more susceptible to pollution than some of the marine beaches.
What else is in the water, though, besides E. coli?
Well, E. coli is an indicator. It indicates that we've got this pollution. And with the fecal pollution comes all different types of hazards that can make us ill. It includes viruses like norovirus, and that gives you a pretty severe case of diarrhea or vomiting. It can include other bacteria like Campylobacter. And that causes both a gastrointestinal illness, but it can also cause reactive arthritis. And it can contain things like parasites, like Cryptosporidium. And that can make you sick for 3 to 5 days.
How exactly is the E. coli getting in the water?
Well, we dispose of our wastes through wastewater treatment plants or through septic tanks. That's how humans dispose of their waste. Animals, of course, if you've got a big animal lot, you might imagine that the manure gets put on, you know, some crops and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so these E. coli and these pathogens get into water because they either get discharged directly from a wastewater plant. They seep in through a leaky septic tank or through inappropriate soil, or they run off of fields where the manure has been, you know,
spread.
Added.
Yeah. Well, infrastructure plays some kind of role here too, because we do have wastewater treatment plants that are intended to address this.
Yeah, a good wastewater treatment plant, one that is state-of-the-art, will remove E. coli and actually kill it. We actually add chlorine generally in wastewater treatment, and we can kill the E. coli and many other pathogens. But one of the problems is when it rains, the wastewater plant takes in a lot of rainwater. It doesn't work as efficiently, so we have a lot more E. coli and pathogens getting into the environment than we would like. So both climate and our infrastructure is playing a role on how these E. coli and pathogens get into our system, into our water systems.
Is the public generally as aware of the importance of clean water on health as they should be, in your view?
In my view, I think that we've taken clean water and safe water for granted. In the United States, if you look, the Clean Water Act got passed in the 1970s. And so we have, you know, 40 years of focusing on clean water. And so we've taken that for granted. We've taken it, we can take a glass of water and drink it without any problem. We can go to a beach and swim and not get sick. But what we're finding now is our pipes are now 40 years old, and our pipes are now 50 years old,
mm-hmm.
and some of our wastewater plants are over capacity, and we have a lot more manure going onto our fields. We have a lot more rain events. So what we're seeing is what looks to be a degradation of our water systems, and we really have to be more vigilant than we have been.
Back to beaches here. How does the health, if you will, of a beach Does that offer any insight into the health of the larger Great Lakes ecosystem?
I think it does. I think these beaches are an indicator of what's going on our shoreline. And our shoreline is so important to us. It's important for the economic vitality of the community. And it looks like with every beach closure, a community can lose almost $200,000 a day. So it's very important. So it's the health of our communities, the health of our wildlife, our own health as we use the beach, not only for recreating and well-being, but the water quality side of it so that we don't get sick.
Would there be an advantage to enabling, I'll say, beach goers to be more vigilant in terms of the water quality?
Well, I think those of us that live in the Great Lakes, we are really fortunate. And what they found with surveys is that most of us really appreciate our shoreline and our beaches. We support monitoring. And I think that those of us that are consumers of these healthy beaches, we can do several things. First of all, we can know what's going on with our beaches. And in the state of Michigan, we do an excellent job. The Department of Environmental Quality does an excellent job monitoring the beaches. You can go right to a website and find out about your local beach. And then you're going to have some knowledge about what may or may not need to be done to keep it healthy or to restore it, you know, restore it to high water quality. You can also do things when you go to the beach. I mean, as a, you know, there's good hygiene at the beach. You know, that you keep your food and your water and your on your towel and all your picnic stuff covered and closed, and you keep it away from the water. You keep it away from the birds. You pick up your trash. You practice good hygiene, like using the restrooms that are nearby and that type of thing. So all of us play a role, I think, in keeping our beaches healthy.
We're talking with Dr. Joan Rose, who's the Nolan Chair in Water Research at Michigan State University, about beach health and related topics. I'm led to believe that sometimes beach closures happen after the fact, and by that I mean by the time the results of a water quality test are known, people have already been swimming in the contaminated water. Are testing methods improving? Is that improving?
That is improving. I mean, you know, our traditional methods are we take a water sample, we run it back to the lab, and we actually grow up the bacteria. We grow up the E. coli overnight, and then we count it. What we're able to do now is actually take the water sample. We can extract the DNA from the bacteria in that water sample, and we can find out how many E. coli are there in a more rapid manner. And now we can get the results in 4 to 6 hours, conceivably. So that is a big improvement to what we were doing before. Other groups are actually using what they call predictive models because they know so much about their beach and they monitored it for so long. They can actually use the winds, the rain, the sunlight to predict whether the E. coli is going to show up at the beach. And they've been able to get their predictions very, very close to the mark. And so this is also another way that many managers are alerting the public early.
Are there any areas of the Great Lakes region that have a notably long history of poor beach health?
You know, we have a number of areas and bays around the Great Lakes that are just more susceptible. And if you think of the Great Lakes, you always hear about Lake Erie and because it's small and shallow. But we have the same kind of things with some of these bays. And it's very interesting over the last few years how coalitions of citizens have come together to try to address their beach health and improve things and improve their ecosystems in general. Saginaw Bay is one of those where they may have, you know, things like Phragmites coming up on the beach, and then they have E. coli and all kinds of invasive species. So they want to restore that ecosystem for fisheries and recreation and beach goers. Another one is Lake Sinclair, and they're really focusing on how they're going to improve their beaches and really improve what they call the blue economy. That is, you know, vitalizing their area because they have this wonderful shoreline that they could take advantage of.
In an article you wrote for the Huffington Post late last year titled "The New and Improved Water Cycle?" You discuss how we need to improve our reuse of water. First of all, what is the new water cycle?
Well, you know, we think of the, when we're in school, I guess, we learn about the hydrologic cycle. And so the rain comes down, it runs off, it goes into the groundwater, goes into the rivers, goes to the lakes, and then evaporates back up into the atmosphere, sort of cycling, and that water moves in this cycle. And that's very true. But what we're finding is that humans have affected every part of that cycle. We've built infrastructure now, so the water flows differently. We've influenced climate. So evaporation is different, and rainfall is different. So all parts of the cycle are very different, and we're seeing this now. We're experiencing this big drought. The whole Midwest experienced this recent drought, and we're seeing more intense rainfall events. So we're seeing these storms, and so we're just seeing all this weather and changing climate, and it's going to continue to change. And under these circumstances, water recycling, because we use a lot of water in our communities, is a viable way to go. And it's going to improve water quality and quantity. They've already started using water recycling in places that are stressed, water stressed, like in Arizona and Southern California, Texas, even Florida, even though we think of Florida as being very wet. They're actually very water stressed because they have a very seasonal rainfall event. And we're starting to see some stress up here in the Great Lakes, even though we have so much water. We want to protect that water. We want to protect our infrastructure. And so recycling makes a lot of sense, even in a water-rich area like the Great Lakes.
Are you persuading a lot of people that there is indeed a new water cycle? Or are you meeting resistance to that idea? I mean, water still evaporates. It still becomes clouds. It still turns into rain. That hasn't changed. But you're arguing that things have changed.
Right. And I think that the scientists, the water engineers, the city planners, at that level, there is clearly a recognition that there's been a change and that we need to plan differently if we're going to continue to have water security. And that means enough water of the right quality for what we want in our communities. So, but I think the next level is getting an understanding of both the science down at the education, like the K through 12. How do we bring in the new science and the new knowledge into the curriculum at the appropriate level so that we're educating the next generation? And also, how do we better communicate this science to the public? Because the public ultimately will be making decisions on whether it's bonds or other financial approaches to improving their infrastructure and looking at how they protect their water. So ultimately, we have to do a better job of communicating this to the public.
Dr. Joan Rose of Michigan State University is the Nolan Chair in Water Research at MSU. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Current State's weekly environmental segment is supported by the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism at Michigan State University. You can find more environmental news online at greatlakesecho.org. A Michigan filmmaker is taking her romantic comedy on the festival circuit, including a screening tonight in New York City. Detroit Unleaded focuses on the personalities who come and go at a gas station in the Motor City. The movie's writer, director, and producer, Roland Nasheff, grew up on the west side of Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Nasheff about the project, which started as a 20-minute short film that premiered at the East Lansing Film Festival.
The East Lansing Film Festival was key because it was the first time that everybody in my life had seen my work, including my family and my cousin Leon Toomey, who finally saw the piece, was really inspired and basically asked me what's next, and I told him, well, based on all of this great reaction from our audience, I think this has to be a feature. And, you know, where Detroit Unleaded the Short was this nonprofit venture, small, and it was me basically fundraising amongst my friends and family. You know, now we had to take it to another level, and I needed an executive producer. And, you know, he really liked that. And, you know, he's a person that spent his life, you know, in the business world, buying and selling businesses and operating, you know, businesses. And so he really liked the idea of like coming on board as my executive producer. And throughout the process, he, you know, he became my producer as well. And so me and him, you know, came together, and it was like a really great partnership. And we produced a film for the first time.
We don't want to give too much away about the plot, but it's safe to say that it's a slow developing, in a lot of ways, awkward romance. Between two young Arab Americans on either side of the bulletproof glass at a well-fortified gas station in the city of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
But what about this girl?
You don't talk to her like that, okay? She's an updo girl.
What's an updo? I want to talk to her.
Forget about her, bro.
I can't call her, I can't talk to her. Why not?
Because she's on lockdown, bro. That's it.
Where did you get the idea to build a romance around this setting?
Well, I was inspired by many different things. When I first moved to Detroit, that's when I began to actually notice gas stations and that they were all owned by Lebanese Americans and Lebanese immigrants. And, you know, I just kept seeing these sort of repeated images of the glass, the bulletproof glass, and these young sort of Arab men behind the glass. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, this has to change your perspective of how you see the world. I felt that the glass was there as this, you know, tangible barrier. It's there to protect you from the other person that's standing on the other side. And I wanted to explore that dynamic. And I also was meeting lots of really great people, you know, within the Arab American community there, because, you know, Detroit is like the highest concentration of Arab Americans outside of the Middle East. And so it was the first time I had lived in such a condensed, like populated Arab community. And so it just seemed that all of our friends either worked at gas stations or owned gas stations, and it seemed to be this rite of passage. And then also I began to notice like how segregated Detroit can be. You know, everybody sort of lives in their own separate neighborhoods, racially, economically. And the gas station, to me, was one of the few places where people actually came together. But it's always done through this bulletproof barrier. And so I wanted to explore that dynamic. It seemed to me like a turnstile where people came in and out of each other's lives. And of course, I had to put like a little love story in there, because to me, it had like all like this environment had all the makings of a really, really good story.
I want to ask you about casting this film, because it seems to me that it would have been challenging to find not just talented actors, but bilingual actors. There's a lot of Arabic spoken in the film with subtitles. Is there an active acting community, theater, movie, film community within Detroit and the Arab American community that helped feed your need for the cast here?
There's so many talented people in Detroit, and talent really came from everywhere. You know, musicians, artists, poets, actors. And so we had a big casting call. We did two of them, one to find our Arab American cast and one to find our customers and all of the supporting roles. And so the Arab American cast was a little bit more challenging because we're, you know, within our community, it's still not something, it's like a little bit more taboo, maybe, you know, to go into acting or theater. And so, but in 2005, when I made the short, we had about 20 people, Arab American actors, show up. In 2010, when we held the casting audition at the Arab American National Museum, we had about 120 people show up. So that really showed me that there was a little bit of a renaissance in our community, and people were just much more open to these possibilities now. So it was really people just coming in because they heard that there was this Arab American film, all of, you know, about 12 roles, young Arab Americans, and it was a positive script, you know, it was a positive portrayal. And I think people were just really excited to hear about something like this and to know that there was, you know, actually a film made about them, you know, about our lives and about our experiences. I had people come in and audition different gas station characters, you know, like I had them make up a gas station character or share their experiences in a gas station. A lot of times that their stories went into the script because it was just so inspiring, you know, or their characters. If they walked in with this great character, I worked it into the script.
I want to ask you about what I consider to be the subtext of the film, aside from the romance, and that is the assimilation into American culture of second-generation Arab Americans, I suppose, to some extent. Was that part of your intent? Is there a message here, not just for Arab Americans who might see the film, but for the rest of us when we see this film?
Well, I don't know if there's necessarily a message, but I did write from my own experience. And in my experience, you know, I grew up with a total lack of positive Arab images. You know, I never saw anybody that looked like me or a family that functioned like mine on television or in the movies. And on the other hand, we were constantly bombarded with negative images of Arabs in the media. And so there was this real missing image for me, you know, is where is everybody else? I was so deeply inspired, you know, by the people around me, by all these wonderful characters that, you know, I was just constantly asking myself, like, where is our experiences? And so I think that's the place where I was writing from. And that's what really drove me. Like, I really want to share this with everybody, you know, and especially the characters. The characters to me were like friends that you really like, that you want to introduce the rest of the world to, you know, that's what the characters felt like to me. And that was always my driving force, is I got to introduce everybody to these people, you know, they're so funny and smart and fun. And, you know, and so that was always my goal.
The rollout of the film has primarily been on the film festival circuit, but at some very major film festivals. You've been in Toronto, you've been in Dubai. Was that part of the plan, or is that just the way it works with a film like yours?
Well, I think it was definitely part of the plan. I want this film to have, you know, a wide of a platform as possible, because I think it's important that people see it, not just because it's entertaining and fun, and I love it because, of course, I made it, but it's, I think it's important to have a diversified Arab image, you know, in the media, in mainstream media as well. To me, that is sharing of culture, and that is the translation of culture. You know, if I can get an audience to sit and laugh with these Arab characters, I think it's going to be harder for them to stereotype, you know, people.
But you must be hoping for general distribution or DVDs or cable, that sort of thing. Is that playing out for you too?
Yes, that's definitely the goal. You need to stay strong on the festival circuit and get your film in front of as many people as possible. And then the goal is to get picked up by a distribution company and to have a theatrical release for the film. You know, this is one of the first, if not the very first, Arab American romantic comedies. And so I think to me it's very important for people to enjoy it in a theater. And our goal is to stay strong on the festival circuit until that happens. And we would like to launch our theatrical release here in Detroit in Lansing, and you know, have it start here and then move to several other cities. And this is our goal by the end of the year.
Roland Nashif is the writer and director of Detroit Unleaded. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. A reminder, we get emails pretty regularly commenting about the music that we air during Current State. Keep in mind, we post the names of the tracks and the artists every day on Twitter at our Twitter handle, which is at KAR Current State. We also want to acknowledge a Mid-Michigan business here in the WKAR listening area that's one winner of a 2013 Detroit Free Press Green Leaders Award, Everlast Lighting of Jackson. is the Free Press's winner in the Green Building Practices category. Everlast makes energy-efficient lighting for highways and streets, parking structures, and other uses, and their new headquarters features geothermal heating and cooling and parking lot lighting that's solar and wind-powered. And it goes on and on. There's more than that going on at Everlast Lighting of Jackson. So congratulations for your award, Everlast, from the Detroit Free Press. For years, eating disorders such as bulimia and the binge-purge subtype of anorexia were thought to be connected to cultural and psychological pressures, especially among girls and women. But a new study by a Michigan State University psychologist indicates binge eating may have biological roots. Dr. Kelly Klump concludes that female rats are more likely to binge eat than males. Her work could influence the science of eating disorders in humans, and Dr. Klump joins me now by phone. Good morning, Kelly Klump.
Good morning.
How did you become interested in studying binge eating? How did you get into this line of work?
Well, binge eating itself, in terms when we think about eating disorders, binge eating is one of the most frequent symptoms of eating disorders. And so it's a symptom that cuts across all the different diagnostic categories of eating disorders. So I've been interested in binge eating per se, because if we can really start to understand what might contribute to this key symptom of eating disorders, we might be able to inform kind of the larger landscape of all of the different types of eating disorders that we see today.
What have psychologists known up to this point about the physiological roots of eating disorders? Has there been a prevailing interpretation of why this happens?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in your intro, for a long time we've known that psychological and cultural factors contribute to the development of eating disorders, but probably starting about 20 years ago, there was an increasing recognition that biological and genetic factors likely contribute to these symptoms and disorders as well. So we've known for about 20 years now that the heritability of eating disorders and their symptoms, like binge eating, approximate the heritability that we see for other psychiatric disorders that we think have a pretty biological basis, like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, etc. So we know that the heritability is around 70% for these symptoms and disorders, and that was kind of the first clue to the field that maybe biological and genetic risk factors might be important, in addition to the psychological and cultural risk factors that we know are important.
And so what have we learned in the last couple of decades about these biological factors?
Well, we have learned, we've started to identify some genes that might increase risk for these symptoms. So you can kind of think about these genes as the background factor. So if you have a genetic risk for eating disorder, it means that you have several genes that increase the probability that you might develop an eating disorder or an eating disorder symptoms, but they don't de facto mean that you will develop it. It's this kind of background genetic risk that then interacts with environmental risk. What we're now realizing, so we know that there are some genes that are involved. What we're trying to do now is figure out what's the intermediary step between the genes and the disorder, and what are the biological processes that likely interact with the psychological and the cultural risk factors. And we're looking at lots of different biological systems. We're looking at things like serotonin functioning, which is known to be implicated in mood disorders. We're looking at reward processes within the brain, dopamine, kind of these neurotransmitters in the brain that increase the chances you're going to want to seek rewards like high-fat, high-sugar foods that we see during a binge, etc. So I would say the eating disorders field in general, we're still kind of catching up to other fields in terms of looking at these biological risk factors, but we're starting to find some systems that are likely involved.
What do your fellow researchers in the field have to say about this? What are your colleagues, what are they saying?
Well, what's interesting is that when I first entered the field about 20 years ago, people were really hesitant to think that genetic and biological risk factors might contribute to eating disorders. But I would say pretty much across the board now, the field of eating disorders, researchers, clinicians, medical doctors, all believe there is a significant genetic and biological risk to these disorders. Now is the key. The key piece for us now is trying to figure out what exactly are these biological factors that increase the risk.
It is pretty extraordinary that we're talking to you this morning, because 39 minutes ago, NPR aired a story, and I'm going to forget the organization, so bear with me on this, but the gist of the story was there is some kind of scientific body that claimed that the handbook, or the manual, I want to say it's for the American Psychological Association, does not include enough data related to genetics and neurological factors in their handbook. And you and I, 40 minutes later, are having this conversation, which is so closely hinged to the genetic and the neurological. Do you have any comment? It's taken 20 years for it to reach this point. Is that too slow in your view? Does this process need to be sped up?
You know, I think all of us would like science to move quicker. If we could get science to move quicker, that means we could figure out the causes and we could end up with more effective treatments quicker. I think the danger there is that we have lots of examples of individuals who rushed in their scientific findings and their scientific data to get findings out into the literature and to prematurely publish results that ended up being false. And the risk with doing that is that you then get treatments that not only get propagated as being perhaps effective for a disorder or a symptom, but that actually aren't effective. You can also get treatments that are put into practice that are actually harmful. So I don't think you'd find any scientist that wouldn't say, yes, let's do this quicker. But I think there's also reason for us all to be careful, thorough, comprehensive in the sorts of research that we do to make sure that we don't disseminate findings and disseminate treatments before we know, A, they're effective, and B, most importantly, they aren't harmful.
What an interesting 21st century conundrum to have. And I suppose it all relates back to how quickly we're able to learn things in 2013. We learn something really important, and then we immediately want to learn what's next as quickly as possible, but the process can only be sped up so much. That's kind of the heart of the issue, correct?
Exactly, yes.
Has your work been peer-reviewed?
Yes.
Okay. And what could be, I'd like to go a little bit further into the genetic implications here. How might this factor into the nature versus nurture theory? What have we learned about, the human genome was such an explosion in terms of knowledge here in the past decade. How might that aid your research?
Well, I'm hoping it will aid my research quite a bit. You know, now from the human genome to where we are in terms of genetic technologies, when we want to look at the genes for a trait or disorder, it used to be 15 years ago, you would pick out 6 genes. And to some extent, you would almost pick them randomly. You would base them on theory, but we had no idea what these genes did. Now, in 2013, I'm currently actually running some samples in my lab looking at human DNA in individuals recruited here in Michigan, and we are looking at 200,000 variants of different genes across the genome. And as you can imagine, having that amount of information available to be able to look to see which of these variants seem to cluster together, which of these variants seem to together increase risk for a symptom or disorder, gives us much more power for understanding the genetic basis of these disorders. We no longer have to kind of guess ahead of time and say, we think it's this, 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 and this, and oh, God forbid, it wasn't those, and you've just spent a lot of money looking at those, and you don't get any bang for your buck. We can now look across all of the different variations of genes in the genome and look using much more powerful statistical approaches for clusters of genes, groups of genes that might be contributing to the trait or disorder. So it's a really exciting time, I would say, for biological and genetic research, and I think another advance over the past 20 years is we can now do this in both humans and animals. And of course, you can do things with animals that you can't do with humans. And so combining the human and the animal approaches, I think, is going to be a really fruitful way to understand not only the genetic basis of these disorders, but then translating the genes that we identify into the biological processes that they code for is going to go a long way in understanding at least that biological genetic piece of the puzzle.
What's the future of the treatment itself, though? I mean, is it premature to leap ahead? I can't help but think forward 20 years or 10 years or whatever. How do you see this impacting treatment?
I do see it impacting treatment, and I see it impacting both pharmacological treatment, so drug treatments for the disorders, but also psychotherapy for the disorders. So, for example, in depression, they're doing really interesting studies where they're looking at individuals who don't respond to psychotherapy for depression, or they don't respond to pharmacological treatment for depression. And what they're doing is they're taking a look at those individuals, and they're looking at their genetic risk, and they're looking at their biology. And what they're finding is that response to different treatments varies depending upon your genetic background. And so where we could be in 10 to 20 years is that if you present to a clinic with a psychiatric disorder, they may run some biological tests, they might grab your DNA, and based on some biological biomarkers and some of the different combinations of genes, they may be able to tell you, given your biological background, this is the treatment that's going to be most effective for you. And so as you can imagine, that is going to decrease suffering, it's going to decrease the cost of mental health care. It could just have huge implications both for the suffering of individuals and also public health in terms of costs for treatment.
Dr. Kelly Klump is a Michigan State University psychologist who studies binge eating and its possibly biological roots. Dr. Klump, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yesterday on Current State, WKAR's Peter Wharf brought us part one of his interview with author John Rosengren about his new book, Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the Hall of Famer's rookie season. Peter and John's Monday discussion focused on Greenberg's early career and the socially and politically turbulent times of the 1930s. A Bronx native and son of Jewish immigrants, Greenberg faced not only the challenges of batting against Bob Feller, Lefty Grove, and Dizzy Dean, but also the rampant anti-Semitism of his time, from players and from fans alike. In part two of their conversation, Peter Wharf and John Rosengren take us to the peak of Hank Greenberg's career and the collision of baseball stardom and World War.
Shortly after Congress implemented the draft, Hank was one of the first players drafted in the spring of 1941. At the time, he was the most popular athlete in America. Remember, spring 41, this is before Joe DiMaggio's hit safely in 56 games, before Ted Williams has hit 400 for what will be the last time. Greenberg is the reigning AL MVP, so he's the best player in his league the previous season, 1940. He's the highest paid ball player of the day, and because baseball is the national pastime, he is the most popular athlete in the country. And he requested that he could play out the 41 season before he went into the Army. Now, this also was before America was in the war. And he knew that his earning potential was greatest when he was at the peak of his career, and that he only had a few years when he could play, and then he wouldn't be able to earn money playing ball anymore. So he wanted to make the most of that. Well, that touched off this national debate where he became the flashpoint for the people arguing, yes, you should be able to pursue the American dream in our capitalist society and make as much money as you can, versus the other side saying, no, when one is called, one should immediately fulfill one's patriotic duty to serve the country. Mm-hmm. Well, it got more complicated when a doctor noticed Hank had flat feet,
right,
and thought he wasn't fit to serve, and people said, hey, wait a minute, you can't. This guy can run around the bases, but he can't march and carry a rifle. So he went in May 7th, 1941, served 8 months. And once he went in, people quickly forgave him and said, good. Where he's doing his duty, and he became a model soldier, and they're happy with him. Well, Congress changed the law. Men over 30 didn't have to serve anymore, and so he was honorably discharged December 5th, 1941. He was eager to resume his playing career, get back in the field with the Tigers, and then, of course, 2 days later, Pearl Harbor's attacked.
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards. Costly to our Navy was the loss of war vessels, airplanes, and equipment, but more costly to Japan was the effectiveness of its foul attack in immediately unifying America in its determination to fight and win the war thrust upon it, and to win the peace that will follow.
Greenberg became the first major leaguer to re-enlist. And when he did so, he knew it was going to be a long war. He figured that the decision to go back in meant that his playing days were over. Well, people lauded him for being willing to make that personal sacrifice for the common good, and to saw him then really as a true hero, not just for the Jewish people, but for Americans. And that's when he really became, you know, a hero of heroes. He served 4 years and didn't get out until 1945. Mid-season, and again was one of the first stars to come back. And that's another amazing story.
It's an amazing story in that Greenberg came back from the war, and in several instances in what remained in the season, went on one of the great comeback tears of all time.
When he came back in July 1945, the country was looking to baseball to recover from the war and the sacrifices the people had made during war. And they turned to the national pastime for healing. And they figured if the national pastime, bad as it had been with in the era of replacement players, could return to its glory, Americans could feel a sense of normalcy again, and that would be healing. And so Greenberg became the test case. If he could do it, they figured the stars that followed could do it. In 4 years in the military, he had played only three exhibition games. Well, many other players played their entire stint. He only played these three games. He was rusty. He was also 34 years old. The cards were definitely stacked against him. But he came back, and in his first game back, he hit a home run. And there was just this delirium in Detroit and around the country that, yes, maybe it is possible. Well, he went through the second half of that season, and on the final day of 1945, baseball season, in the ninth inning, Greenberg hit a grand slam to clinch the pennant for the Tigers. And people rejoiced all over. In Detroit, they rejoiced. Jews around the country rejoiced. And there's in Aviva Kempner's film, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg, Senator Carl Levin quotes the Detroit newspaper that said, "Call him the hero of heroes, call him the champion of champions." And he says, "I almost weep saying that, you know, 50 years later, remembering just what a great feeling it gave him as a little kid when he was maybe 9 years old, listening to that game on the radio and running around his house like crazy after Greenberg hit the home run."
It's the War Victory Series between the Cubs and Tigers, managed by two veteran campaigners, Charlie Grimm and Steve O'Neill. It's the sixth game of the series. Hank Greenberg comes to bat in the eighth inning with one on and the Cubs leading 7-5. Ray Prim, who replaced the injured Claude Passo, is pitching for the Cubs, who have to win to send the series into a seventh game. Greenberg hammers the ball into the left field bleachers and ties the score 7-7.
Hey, John, have you ever sat around and thought about who you would cast in the movie?
Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
I don't know who would be the... Channing Tatum, maybe. I'm not sure who would play the best Greenberg. You know, Greenberg himself had these movie star
exactly.
good looks. He's 6'4".
Yeah.
He wears his hair a little longer than anyone else. The only problem is he was a terrible actor. There's this film called The Kid from Cleveland. I don't know if you've seen it. Bill Veeck, in 1949, allowed a film crew to film this movie about this kid who kind of hides out at the ballpark, picks refuge at the ballpark, and there are a bunch of players in it, Lou Boudreau and others from the Indians. But Hank and Beck are in it, and Hank has a couple lines, and he says them just so stiffly and so, it's kind of like with a smirk on his face, like, "Can you believe I'm doing this?"
That was a good clean single, son.
Yeah, as good as Luke could do and not nearly so expensive.
Better, Bill, especially against a pitcher like that.
Who was pitching?
A ghost, I guess, Mr. Greenberg.
Did you ever bet against a ghost, Hank?
I sure did. His name was Dizzy Dean. I never even saw the ball.
I think it was the beginning and the end of his film career.
John, let me ask you about another scene that I thought was very touching. And that's the story of Hank and a young woman named Marjorie Nash. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little bit of this story.
Okay.
From the chapter, The Golden Mark. With every home run he hit, Hank received a card in the mail. The envelopes, addressed simply to Briggs Stadium, Detroit, each had a silhouette drawing of number 5, completing his swing with a ball, showing the number of the homer he had just hit. Inside was a stick figure cartoon and a short note. They came from an art student at Wayne State College named Marjorie Nash. She had started sending cards in 1935. She also sent ballplayers and movie stars of the day, Jimmy Stewart, Barbara Stanwyck, Clark Gable, Betty Davis, Fred McMurray, etc., skillfully rendered pencil sketches that they returned autographed. She received her first signed portrait from Greenberg in September 1935, noting in her diary, "Hank sent my picture back autographed. He also sent me a card. He's a swell guy."
Yeah, it's sweet, isn't it?
It is.
So the two of them struck up first this pen pal relationship, but then they met, and they seemed to really like each other. Hank would give her passes to come to games, and she would continue to send these notes whenever he hit a home run. And they exchanged gifts that Christmas time, and Hank bought her some perfume. And so they became close. And one day, Hank went to visit her at her house, and Marjorie's younger brother was just beside himself. Like, here comes Hank Greenberg, you know, the star of the Detroit Tigers, pulling up his car in front of their house, and he's all gaga, and the mother sends him out back to play and leaves them alone. So Hank comes in, he spends a little time at the house with Marjorie, meets her mother, and leaves. And when Maurice, Marjorie's father, found out about this, he was livid. He said, "I don't ever want that Jew coming in my house again."
Wow.
And as a working class man in Detroit, he unfortunately spoke what many of the people thought. And as a result, Marjorie broke off the relationship, and the two never did see each other again. So she kept his autographed picture up on her dresser.
So that sweet story ends up very bitter and sad.
Right. And an unfortunate reminder of the depth of feeling, the antipathy toward Jews during that time. You know, it was a time when anti-Semitism was as widely practiced and as socially acceptable as Jim Crow laws.
John Rosengren is the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes, published in 2013 by New American Library. John, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us about Hank Greenberg.
You're welcome, Peter. My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
America, Land, wo sich lieb, steh ich bei ihr, möglich sei ihr, überall echt das Schall und Schlieb, von die Berge zu die Prairies, bis die Armin weiß mit Schall.
And coming up tomorrow on Current State, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Greater Lansing chapter of First Book. Also, we discuss the importance of preserving Michigan's history. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. Again, if you want to know more about the music we play on Current State, check us out on Twitter at KAR Current State. We tweet our music playlist daily. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joel Instroth is the producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.